This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. You can access shows live or as podcasts by going online to kuci.org. This is the In the Garden Show produced by the UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. I am Ann Liu, your KUCI radio host for the hour. This week's topic is bird-friendly gardens. In the last 3 years of our show, we've covered soil, bugs, plants, and landscaping, but we haven't done a show on a very important element of a beautiful garden, and that is birds. They fill the garden with delightful sounds of life, and we hear them even before we see them flittering and moving through our garden. I am excited to have two bird experts today as my guests. First, we have Trudy Hurd, who is the Director of Education at Sea and Sage Audubon Society. She's also nicknamed the Queen of the Marsh, that is, the San Joaquin Wildlife Sanctuary. Welcome to the show, Trudy.
Welcome, Ann. We're very glad to be here.
She's been director of education there for 25 years. That really does make her queen. Do you like that name?
I do. I feel very comfortable in the 300 acres there.
Second, we have Carolyn Noble, who is education chair and board member of Sea and Sage Audubon Society. She just recently was guest speaker about backyard birds to the Tustin Garden Club. Welcome to the show, Carolyn.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're very, very happy to have both of you come to KUCI Studio 88.9 FM in the Garden Show. Our topic is bird-friendly gardens, and we'll be covering how to create a bird-friendly garden in Orange County. Plants favorable to birds, keeping bird nests safe and our trees healthy, and end with talking about the 6,600 square foot demonstration pollinators garden that benefits local hummingbirds and native bees, right in our backyard across from UCI at the San Joaquin Wildlife Sanctuary. We have lots of interesting stuff to cover, so let's begin. Trudy, let's begin with the first topic. Tell me about how to create a bird-friendly garden in Orange County.
Well, this is a very exciting year, 2018, because it is the year of the bird. According to the National Audubon Society, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and National Geographic Society, it's the 100-year anniversary of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is the law that protects birds, and not just their actual bodies, but also their feathers, their nests, their chicks. So it's a very exciting year to be thinking about things that we can do to help birds, such as creating a bird-friendly garden.
First, what would you recommend we do for making a bird-friendly garden?
Well, you think about Orange County and the diversity of habitats that used to be here that our homes are now covering. So we don't want birds just to be using the native habitats as they're migrating through Orange County. We also want them to use our backyards, if our backyards are bird friendly.
And how do we make our backyard gardens bird friendly?
The first thing to do is to increase the habitat. And that can be done in a number of ways, such as planting native plants. It can be removing the non-native plants. And it can be increasing things like the leaf litter and keeping the trees healthy for nesting.
Now, increasing leaf litter, in my bird class, I just recently found out how important it is for leaf litter to be in the garden. Can you tell the audience why?
Roughly 95% of our native birds are eating insects, especially the caterpillars of moths and butterflies, at some time during their lifetime, especially during nesting season and especially during migration. So by keeping leaves on the ground, that's providing a habitat for these caterpillars and insects. So the insect-eating birds will come down and they'll kick through the leaf litter and pick out the bugs. The seed-eating birds also will kick the leaf litter and eat the bugs that are there.
I can see that happening in my own garden. Lots of little holes and dips in the soil because birds have been kicking around the soil.
It also helps your native plants because it's keeping the weeds from growing and also keeps some of the moisture down in the soil.
Now, let's talk about some of these native plants.
Oh, my goodness. Do we have 20,000 hours to talk about them? There are an incredible number of native plants that you can use.
Let me go back. We'll talk about plants for the garden in our second section, but let's just talk about the flower nectar eating birds and then the berry eating birds and the insect eating birds and the seed eating birds. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of plants that these different types of birds eat.
Well, most people are thinking about hummingbirds as birds that they want to help in the yard. And I'm a lazy person. I don't want to make sugar water for them to eat. So I plant plants. And these are things like the island bush snapdragon, which has long red leaves or long red flowers for the hummingbirds to eat. It's a beautiful plant, year-round green, and has those flowers present almost all year. Wintertime is kind of hard for hummingbirds because there's not a lot of flowers in flower. The manzanita is a perfect Southern California plant to put in your yard because it has flowers in wintertime. California fuchsia has beautiful red flowers, and the penstemons have beautiful purple flowers that the hummingbirds will nectar from.
And these plants can flower at different seasons so that you can have flowers that feed these nectar-eating birds throughout the seasons, correct?
Correct. And in the summertime, orioles will migrate north from their tropical areas to breed in Orange County, and they will also be using these types of plants.
And how about warblers?
Warblers are insect eaters, and so they need to find insects to pick off of the leaves. And just about every native plant that you can think of for Orange County will be beneficial to warblers.
And other insect-eating birds like?
Bush tits. They will come to bladder pod, encelia, which is the bush sunflower, any kind of mallow. And they'll flit in and out in between the leaves and pick all those little bugs off.
And this is a great way to control insects in the garden. We're not limited to using jet spray to get rid of the insects on the plants. We can do it organically by having birds as part of the ecosystem.
We call the birds the nature's insecticides.
I like that. Beats, it saves us work too. I'm all for saving myself labor in the garden.
Because what used to be here is an ecosystem in balance between the plants and between the birds and all of the insects and the lizards. So we're trying to duplicate that again in our yards.
And how about those berry-eating birds?
Oh, yes. Toyon, which is a beautiful plant that folklore says used to cover the Hollywood Hills, and that's where Hollywood got its name because toyon is also called hollyberry. This plant has beautiful flowers in fall that turn into red berries around Thanksgiving and Christmas time. And that's the perfect time for robins and cedar waxwings and our northern mockingbird to pluck those berries off and get a good meal.
And they're wonderful. The plant is also wonderful for making a wreath for your front door as well.
Yes, you can do that.
And along with those berry-eating birds, they also like coffee berry?
Yes, coffee berry and lemonade berry. These are all in the sumac family. They have large leaves and big berries, which are perfect for the birds to eat.
This is really, really making me want to explore more of these plants so that I can grow them in my garden. They're natives, so they use less water, and we can replace some of our traditional plants little by little until we have a very drought-friendly, bird-friendly garden.
That's excellent, because the non-native plants don't support the native insect population. Something like 100 times more insects are found in the native plants than in the non-natives. So if you're looking at birds that are migrating through Orange County, in addition to the native birds that are here all year long, they need a food source. And it's so much better if your backyard has native plants.
There must be a reason why, see in Sage Audubon House, you have the Native Plant Society meeting there. You work hand in hand together, don't you?
We do. We use each other as resources all the time.
And let's not forget the seed-eating birds.
Yes, sparrows, towhees, juncos. They're going to be down usually on the ground where all the seeds from the flowers have fallen. And so seed-eating birds will feed off of, just about any flower that produces seeds. Personally, I like Hooker Eye's evening primrose. It's a little bit messy looking after it's done flowering, but those flowers are big and yellow, very pretty to look at, in addition for native bees like carpenter bees and bumblebees to be feeding off of. And then after it's flowered, all those seeds, hundreds, thousands of seeds are falling onto the ground. And so year round, the goldfinches in your yard will come and they'll pick off of the plant in addition to going down onto the ground and picking up those seeds.
It's so delightful to just sit in my backyard and with my binoculars look at all the birds that come and visit. I have a lot of yarrow.
Yarrow is a good one. It's a nice ground cover. It can be used as a replacement for your turf. And yes, the birds will eat that. Now, Carolyn, do you have something to add?
Well, what you've just been describing so beautifully is what I'm going after in my newly planted all-native plant yard. And you've been describing the levels or the layers of bird plants that I'm trying to achieve. You ended with the yarrow, which is along the ground, basically a lovely ground cover. But then you described so nicely the berries that grow on my toyon. My toyon is now about 9 feet tall and loaded with beautiful berries. And my lemonade bush is catching up quickly and also loaded with berries, tiny berries. And I notice different birds coming to those than the ones that are rather skulking and go along under my lower bushes and plants.
This may sound very overwhelming to the public listening to the names of birds and the names of plants. I'm going to see if we can post this on our website, on our mgorange.ucanr.edu website. You can look for that soon to come. No doubt this is going to be helpful for our gardeners as well as our bird lovers. There's something important to say about the all North American native birds, how they're protected.
Yes, all birds are protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. And this is the first of an environmental law in the United States. And it has helped recover not just endangered species like the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon, but also gives protection to our backyard birds.
And that includes all parts of the bird.
Yes, feathers, nests, eggs. So if you find a nest in your backyard, you have to leave it there and not try to move it because it is protected by federal law.
We will be talking about how to protect these nests with healthy trees in a little bit. Let me just take a little break and remind our listeners that you are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is the In the Garden show, and our particular show is Bird-Friendly Gardens. And I am hosting right now Trudy Hurd and Carolyn Noble from See and Sage Audubon Society, the Education Division. Let's go on. You mentioned for creating a bird-friendly garden. We just finished talking about selecting locally native plants for the garden. Let's go on to another part of creating a bird-friendly garden. How about water?
Water is probably the most important out of all of these things. And most birds, though, don't want a deep fountain. They use shallow water. So if you're going to buy a fountain, see if you can get a recirculating fountain or one that's solar powered, and make sure it has different levels on it so that the birds can come in from the side, take a sip, or jump in and bathe. They don't want it too deep, so again, make sure that it's shallow. You can use the glass decorative bird baths, because those are shallow at the edges and a little bit deeper in the middle, so that a mockingbird could jump into the middle and take a bath, or a phoebe or goldfinch could get along the edges where it's not too deep. And just remember to be sure to clean the water a couple times a week, because you don't want any disease-causing organisms to hurt the birds. You want to help them.
Can you tell me in detail how to clean? Do we use something special other than water?
No, just a brush to brush along the edges for where some of the algae may be growing, and just dump it out, rinse it with fresh water, and refill it.
One of the fun things about the different levels is I have a rather deep fountain in my backyard. When I say deep, it's maybe 5 inches deep, and I do have two different species of hawks that use that deeper water source frequently, and then I have a tiny drip of water, and the goldfinches love the drip of water, and I often think perhaps it's the sound as well as just the fact that it's shallow. They're tiny birds, so you can really have fun creating your bird fountain to suit the birds in your yard.
They definitely are attracted to the sound of dripping water.
And how about providing nesting niches?
Well, if you have one little area that you add water to the mud, you just might get a black phoebe or a cliff swallow using that mud to make a mud nest on the side of your chimney or under the eaves of your house. So that's kind of fun to do.
And I use several bird houses, not the painted fancy ones. They're adorable, but I just use the raw wood. I think they're made out of cedar, and I buy them at a bird warehouse, if you will. And I get, a variety of wrens that really keep my insects down. And then I also now have two Western bluebirds.
Wow.
That are coming to one of my birdhouses.
That's wonderful, because bluebirds once were diminishing in population. Mm-hmm. When I go to parks for birding, I see bluebird boxes way up high in the trees. Can you add a little bit about those bluebird boxes we see in the parks?
Well, they're being monitored by the Western Bluebird Society. So there are volunteers who go out during the breeding season, and they're monitoring how many eggs are in there, how many young are there, how many are fledging out of there. They're making sure that these birds are protected. That's why you saw that they were very high up, so that cats can't crawl up to them and people can't hurt them. And then in between the seasons, the volunteers are cleaning those out so that all the little nest parasites and mites aren't going to damage the next brood, the next round of nesting.
Which, and I just learned that 244 baby Western bluebirds fledged last year in Irvine Regional Park. And they've worked very hard to create a bluebird house trail, if you will. And so this is very exciting for us that live in Orange County.
Woohoo! Yeah, that is exciting.
Now, well, the natural thing to do is to keep your trees intact, even when they're dead. Woodpeckers are making the holes, or the holes are natural. And not only the woodpeckers are nesting there, but then in subsequent years, those Western bluebirds can also nest there, in addition to tree swallows and the wrens and some of the other nesting cavity birds.
In our man-made nest box that we have in our backyard, do you recommend that we clean the boxes when it's off-season?
I sure do. And I have found, you'll find a number of different spider webs in the corners, and then you'll sometimes find tiny mites. And I've read that the mites are really, I don't know that they would kill the bluebirds, but they certainly must be pesty to the bluebirds as they come in there. So yes, I clean mine out just with a brush, an old paintbrush, in between seasons, and it seems to work well.
Do you need to spray it with anything?
I don't spray anything in there because birds, they're sensitive, they're tiny, and I don't think we want to pollute any of the corners of our yards. We need to have a totally bird-friendly yard.
Great information. I think that's really important for the general public to know, because many times we have good intentions but don't realize how we can make harm to these little lovely creatures. Now, how about reducing harm? These hummingbird feeders, they're so popular at the gardening stores. Should I clean it with a little bit of vinegar, weakened vinegar, in between? How can I keep those feeders clean? Or I don't even use mine anymore. What do you recommend?
Well, I do put up 5 or 6 hummingbird feeders every year in my yard, if I can keep up with it, because it is important to clean them out, almost daily in the summer when it's hot, and I think there could be bacteria in those glass bottles, and I use a baby bottle brush and brush them out thoroughly, and I do use a tiny bit of vinegar in there, but rinse it then very carefully, and I don't use the red food dye just because there's some questions about the safety of that. You don't need it. And the joy is that not only hummingbirds come to those feeders, but hooded orioles drain those feeders all through the summer. It's just amazing to watch.
It's so fun. I have a friend who has many, many of these feeders all throughout her garden. And when it's really hot, she has a mister. Have you seen those misters you attach to the holes? And the birds fly right through the mist and get a drink and then fly. They're just so happy.
That sounds great.
How about those cats? What should we do about those cats?
Keep them indoors and enjoy them in there. They're cuddly, they're lovely, but if you want to have a bird-friendly garden and if you want to protect other wildlife, I've read where cats are very detrimental to the lizard population, to grasshoppers, other things that we need to take care of. But to have a cat in your house is a lovely thing.
I've heard of catios. You want to talk about these catios?
Well, that's like there's aviaries for outdoor or birds that are kept in aviaries. Well, this is like an aviary for a cat so that it can go outside but still not be impacting the birds and the natural wildlife. It's like a playpen. It's made out of wire, wood. It can have multiple levels. I've seen some that are like tunnels going from the house to the garage. But again, it's keeping your cat safe, and that safety is from attacks from other cats, attacks from owls at night. It's keeping them safe from all kinds of diseases. So we want to be sure that our pets are safe and that our backyard wildlife is safe. Unfortunately, I have a neighbor who lets his cat roam. And it's a fallacy that a well-fed cat will not kill. Unfortunately, the hunting instinct is instinctual. It's there. And so even if they've fed, they will see a moving bird, they will see a lizard, and they'll try to catch it and kill it. Even if they don't kill it outright, the bacteria that's in a cat's teeth will kill the bird later.
Now, these birds, reducing harm, how do we protect the fledglings?
Well, fledgling is a word that means the bird is learning to fly. And there's a period of time from when songbirds are leaving the nest after they've been chicks, and they're learning to fly, kind of like toddlers in the human world. And in the human world, the parents are still taking care of that toddler. Well, guess what? The adult birds are taking care of their fledgling. So we come along and we look at this little bird on the ground, and it doesn't have quite all of its flight feathers. And we think, oh, the poor bird, it's abandoned. I need to rescue it.
Mm.
And instead of rescuing it, we're actually kidnapping it.
Mm.
So that bird doesn't need to go to the rehabilitator, who is very experienced and can take care of it. It's actually being removed from its natural habitat. The parents are keeping an eye on it. They're still feeding it as it's hopping around. And in a couple of days, it'll be ready to fly and, you know, take care of itself on its own. So what we can do in the meantime is keep our pets indoors, especially our dogs, because they'll think that's something real interesting. It's a little squeaky toy that's moving.
Mm-hmm.
And that little bird can then be in the bushes and eventually learn to fly and fly away.
That's interesting. I know a lot of young children feel sorry for those little baby birds and want to help. And so this is very important information. How about rodents?
Well, we sure don't like rodents in our houses or in our yards. Especially rats can carry diseases, and they can chew through our insulation and cause all kinds of problems. In a natural habitat, you would have all kinds of wildlife eating those rodents, things like hawks and owls, foxes and bobcats. But with our backyards, we do not want to put out poison to get rid of those rodents, because if you put out poison, when the mouse or the rat eats it, as it's dying, it's wandering around and staggering, and the hawks and the owls will look at that and think, oh, there's an easy-to-catch meal. I'm not going to go after the fast-moving animal. I'm going to go after that staggering one. And so they'll eat that poisoned rodent and then get that poison in themselves and die. It's really sad to see. Not only hawks and owls can be killed by these poisoned rodents, but also our pets. And I know of people who have had pet dogs that have died because of this. So we may not want to use a snap trap because it doesn't look good, but there are some snap traps that are covered that you can use, and it's more humane for the rodent. You don't want to poison something or have a sticky trap that it's going to get stuck in and cause all kinds of anxiety. We want to be helpful to wildlife, but in addition to the birds. So if we have to get rid of a rodent in our yard, it's much better to humanely use a snap trap.
I have one suggestion on using snap traps. Because I occasionally do use snap traps because we have lots of roof rats in our neighborhood. But I set my alarm for like 4 a.m. and go out and remove that snap trap or close it if it hasn't caught something during the night. Because invariably, the bait that you've put in it is also going to appear tasty to maybe our little towhee or some of our ground birds. And I have to admit, I caught a towhee one day.
Aww.
Accidentally, and I cried for the rest of the day. It broke my heart. And I've heard of other people saying the same thing. So I set it after dark, and I get up in the morning before the sun comes out, or before dawn, and remove it. Often, last year I caught 13 rats this way in my yard, but you have to make sure that you get the trap out of there before daylight.
Birds are most important for the garden, mainly because they eat bugs.
A bird-friendly garden is a bug-friendly garden.
The majority of backyard birds eat insects.
Mm-hmm. And moth caterpillars especially are eaten by a lot of birds. So when we have our native plants, they will go ahead and eat all of those caterpillars. We don't have to put out poisons for them.
Yeah, like aphids and scale insects. We can handle that with jet spraying and just keeping the garden friendly with those ideas that we have been talking about. The water, the types of plants we grow, and reducing the harm with having clean feeders. All those great ideas that you have been giving us. This is about the halftime hour show, and I want to just take a short station break to let you know that you are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org online. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. This is the In the Garden show, produced by the UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. The name of this show is Bird Friendly Gardens, and I am Ann Liu, interviewing Trudy Hurd, Project Director of Education at C.N. Sage Audubon Society, as well as Carolyn Noble, Education Chair and Board Member of C.N. Sage Audubon Society. Now, let's return to our interview with them. The first half of the show, we have been talking about creating a bird-friendly garden in Orange County. And Trudy has given us resources about birds and plants. Should we just repeat them really quickly?
Yes. We want to increase the habitat, which means planting native plants. It means making our habitat layers, providing nesting niches, making our yard bug-friendly. And then it also means to reduce harm, to reduce pesticides or not use them at all, to not rescue fledglings, to keep our cats indoors, prune our trees in fall and winter when it's healthier for the tree and we're not cutting down any bird nests. And what we haven't mentioned yet is making our windows visible to birds. This seems to be a huge problem with birds, and millions of them are dying every year by colliding with our windows and dying.
What should we do about that? That's happened in my home.
I know. If you talk to everybody, everyone at least once has that happen. So we want to make it visible. Now, if you go ahead and buy one of those little hawk silhouettes and stick it in your window, I'm sorry. Thank you for thinking about that, but it doesn't work because the birds aren't seeing that as a hawk, and they're going to go ahead and fly right through. You would have to cover your entire window with those little hawk silhouettes. The birds are seeing the reflection of sky and plants in that window, and they think they can fly through it. So if some of your windows have screens on them, that's great. They're already protecting you or protecting the bird. You can close the drapes and the blinds at night or when you're not home so that they don't see the silhouette. If you want to use decals, you're going to have to use a lot of them. They have to be spaced about 2 to 4 inches apart because birds, when they're flying through a tree, they're going between the branches that are 2 to 4 inches apart. So that's an important number to know, that whatever you're going to do, if you're going to hang streamers or paint a little design on your windows, it has to be 2 to 4 inches apart. Also, if you have indoor plants, make sure that they're not right next to the window where a bird might see it and think it can fly and sit on it.
Resources, groups that can support the public. We have the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Yes, they're located in New York, and they've done a lot of research. So if you go to their website, All About Birds, they have an online field guide about birds. So you can learn about the nesting and the life history and what the birds eat. So say you've got a mourning dove that decides it's going to nest on your front door or next to your front door right when you're getting ready to paint your house. You can go to online All About Birds and look up mourning doves to see, okay, how long does it take for them to incubate the eggs? And then once the eggs hatch, how long it takes for those young birds to fledge and leave? So that way you can adjust your home improvement project without hurting the birds. Because remember, those birds are protected by federal law, and you don't want to hurt the bird and you don't want to get in trouble with the law.
And right now would be a good time to put a plug in for C.N. Sage Audubon Society, how you can help the general public.
We've got lots of resources on our website. We've got friendly volunteers. If you call the Audubon House, they'll be happy to talk with you about birds in your backyard. You can come out on the second Sunday of the month and take a bird walk at the San Joaquin Wildlife Sanctuary, which also not only shows birds of the marsh, but talks about our backyard birds.
And I love the pollinator's garden. We'll talk about that later in the show. And the California Native Plant Society is an excellent resource for information.
They certainly are. They have a wonderful website called CalScape, which is kind of like California Landscape. So if you want to find out if a plant is perfect for your yard, You just type in your zip code and they'll list all kinds of plants for your area, and then you can look up the details about them to see how tall it grows, how much water does it need, and things like that that'll help you make your decision about the plants for your yard.
And nearby in San Juan Capistrano, we have the Tree of Life Nursery.
They're a wonderful resource that's local. You can go out there on a Saturday morning, and they have free workshops on backyard birds, plants for butterflies, plants for bees, how to get rid of your turf, how to irrigate, and all of that is free. And then they've got all the plants to sell you, which are very beautiful and very inexpensive.
These are all wonderful resources. Carolyn, do you want to add one more?
I do. It's exciting to take a class out there, or even to pretend that you have to go to the restroom, because the restrooms are located and the classes are located in a real barn, full-size barn, that is left from this big ranch where this nursery is now located. And just going to the nursery is just the most, it's almost a spiritual experience. It's just so lovely out there under the oak trees.
It's right next to the Casper's Wilderness Park.
Yes.
So you can go to Casper's. They have a little drip fountain and some feeders, so you can watch the birds there and then go just right next door to Tree of Life and pick up a few plants to take home.
We have a wonderful podcast. I remember interviewing the owner of Tree of Life Nursery.
Mike Evans.
Yes, and that one you can find on our archive of podcasts called Native Plant Nursery. You can find our podcasts on mgorange.ucanr.edu. So those are resources about birds and plants. I'm not sure. Did you say the website for Sea and Sage?
Well, the hard part is learning how to spell Audubon. So it's at seaandsageaudubon.org, which is SEAANDSAGEAUDUBON.org.
Great. It's a great website. I found lots and lots of information about that. Both Trudy and Carolyn have been giving great ideas about making a bird-friendly garden. And if you feel like this is way too much information, you have these websites to look at. You can re-listen to this podcast. It will be in our archive for Master Gardeners. The second section for our interview will be on plants. I know we have talked a little bit about plants so far. Let's talk about your plant list that I would like to have put onto our Master Gardener website too. Plant list for a bird-friendly garden in Orange County, California, because there is another Orange County in Florida, right?
Yes.
All right. Talk about that. It's by height.
Well, the smaller ones are things like the Dudleas, which are succulents, and they have flowers that the hummingbirds love. There are sticky monkey flower, which has a beautiful orange flower that's perfect for hummingbirds to stick their beaks into. California fuchsia, which gets a little messy looking during some times of the year, but the rest of the year has the beautiful red flowers. Hooker eyes evening primrose, which I mentioned already, with the yellow flowers for the goldfinches. Scarlet bugler and showy penstemon are penstemons with long flowers for hummingbirds. Hummingbird sage, oh, that likes the shade. So if you have an area under a tree, you can put hummingbird sage, which will spread out and sends up a stalk of beautiful deep red flowers. And then some of the needle grasses, purple thryon and purple needle grass, will have those seeds for the seed-eating birds. All of these that I just mentioned are less than 3 feet tall.
And the beautiful thing about these plants that you're naming is that many of them are in the demonstration garden that we're going to talk about soon.
They are, yes. So plants then that get a little bit taller, say between 3 and 5 feet, this is like the bush sunflower, California buckwheats, coffeeberry, which we've mentioned, island bush snapdragon, which is one of my favorites. That can be trained to grow up over an arbor or it can just be sprawling out over other plants, or it can be a nice mound. It's green all year long, and it's found normally on the Channel Islands, but does well here in our Orange County habitat. Bladder pod. Now this one, we, with our school tours, laugh because some of the kids will say it's stinky, and other kids will like it because it smells like bell pepper. It has a long yellow flower on it, and after it flowers, it creates a seed pod with real big seeds inside. And the hummingbirds like it, and the bees like it, and also the warblers. When I left for work 2 days ago, there was a hummingbird and an orange-crowned warbler that were feeding in my bladder pod. So laugh about the name, but it's definitely a bird-friendly plant. Any of the mallows, San Clemente bush mallow or chaparral mallow, will be wonderful. It has a nice big geranium-shaped leaf, looks good all year long. And then the sages. Now, sadly, I have asthma and allergies, so I can't have sages in my backyard. But boy, are these bird magnets. White sage, Cleveland sage, black sage, purple sage. If you have those in your yard, you'll definitely have plants or have birds, and they look good year-round. And then finally, the plants that are 5 feet and more, and this is for the, you know, areas in your yard where you can support a bigger plant, the manzanitas get big. Ceanothus, there's several varieties that can be small or tall, but those are a nice big bush, green year-round, provide beautifully intense blue flowers that the birds and the bees love. There's also toyon, which we've mentioned. Western elderberry is a plant that will support all kinds of insects, things coming to the flowers. It provides berries. So you'll get a variety of birds coming to western elderberry. Another tree-like plant is the western redbud, called redbud because the flowers are pinkish red, and then they produce these long seed pods that will drop off and provide seeds for your seed-eating birds. Now, if you want something humongous, there's two plants that are good bird magnets, and that's the western sycamore and coast live oak. You have to have a big yard, though, for those two.
And I have both of those in my yard, and they actually, I have several oak trees that now have actually attracted my first acorn woodpecker. I was so excited to see that. And my sycamore is big enough that there are many holes in it from past woodpeckers who have been around. And so I keep watching it to see what else might nest in those holes.
If you want to know how to take care of your trees, what you want to do is make sure that even if a portion of the tree is dead looking, if it does not provide or it is not a liability issue, go ahead and leave that dead portion there. As we mentioned earlier, woodpeckers and other cavity nesting birds will use that dead portion. If you do need to get rid of that branch, you want to cut it in fall or in winter. This is when the trees have gone dormant, so you can cut that branch without damaging the internal structure of the plant. When you cut the plant, you don't want the diseases that are on the outside of the trunk to get inside. That trunk is providing a nice barrier. It's like skin, so it's providing some protection from diseases. So by trimming your tree in fall and winter, you're not only helping the birds, but you're also helping the tree. You're not impacting the bird nests. So many times we get calls at Audubon House from people where their gardeners have cut a tree in springtime because they didn't see the hummingbird nest or the goldfinch nest. These birds, they know they want to be hidden, so they're not going to put that nest out where we can see it so easily. Remember, please trim your plants in fall and winter.
What if the nests are active? What should we do about that?
Keep your distance. They're fun to watch. You can get a pair of binoculars to use to watch the parents bringing food to their nests and their chicks. You can watch the development, and it's very fun to watch.
And what if we see tree trimmers or people disturbing these nests? Is there something we should do?
Yes, you can get that stopped. You can call the local authorities. You can call Fish and Game. I guess it's now called Fish and Wildlife. And let those people know that that nest is protected by federal law and that they should not be cutting or hurting that nest.
And when you call, it helps to send them a photograph, maybe.
Yeah, go ahead and photograph the nest if you can. Photograph the people that are cutting the nest. Get a photograph of the truck so that you know who those people are that are not listening to you.
Important information. Now we've covered three large areas in this interview, and we have saved one of the best for last, and that is something, Trudy, that you have worked many, many hours on in developing this demonstration garden at San Joaquin Wildlife Sanctuary. You can do some bragging here. Tell us about it.
I've worked at the San Joaquin Wildlife Sanctuary for the past 25 years. It's been a wonderful partnership between the Irvine Ranch Water District, which owns the property, and Sea and Sage Audubon Society as an environmental group that's doing educational programs at the sanctuary for the Water District. It's been so great that I've wanted to do something to say thank you to the Water District and also somehow create a demonstration for the public that they can see native plants that they can put in their yard that will benefit wildlife so that they don't have to use Mediterranean plants that even though they don't use a lot of water, that still they're not as beneficial for the wildlife as using California natives. So in the year 2015-16, my education assistant and I had a lot of help from volunteers that we were able to create this huge garden, 6,600 square feet, that we could plant plants for hummingbirds and then plants for native bees.
I was totally impressed when I dropped by to invite Trudy to be my guest for the show. Totally impressed. So nearby, kitty corner across from UCI campus.
It's also close to the freeway, the 405, so that you can get off and go take a walk through the garden, smell the smells of the sage, hear the wonderful sound of the recirculating water fountain, hear the sounds of the birds. And we have a plant list and a brochure about the pollinator's garden right there at the garden in a little kiosk. And then you can go out and walk the trails, 10 miles of walking trails along the 300 acres. And then you can see the plants in their native habitat.
Wow. Definitely a place to visit to get ideas on what you can do to change your garden so it becomes more bird friendly.
Most of our yards they're exposed to full sun. The soil is very clay. And what we can do is, since this is kind of a drought area, we have a Mediterranean climate where there's not a lot of water in the summer. It's very mild winter, is to plant all of these different kinds of California natives that will still benefit the wildlife.
And I can even find the names of the plants that you've named on Pollinator's Garden Plant List in Sea and Sage, right?
Correct, yes. We have a resource. You can go to our website and get the plant list. Also, when you walk through the garden, we have the plants named on little labels, so you can decide which ones you like that you can plant at home.
It's a beautiful, beautiful demonstration garden. I highly recommend it to anyone interested in a beautiful garden, in native plants, and in wildlife, in native bees as well as hummingbirds. Let's talk a little bit more about the native bees, because you have some nesting places for bees there.
We do. One of our summer camp kids is now an Eagle Scout, and so he made for us some multi-storied bee nesting areas. Most people are familiar with the non-native European honeybee, and this is the bee that makes hives, defends the hives, makes honey. Well, most of our native bees, and there's about 1,000 of them in California, they don't make hives, they don't make honey, they nest solitary in little holes in branches, trees, some of them in the ground, some of them in leaf litter, some in wood. They might nest near other bees, so you might see a lot of them, but they aren't defending their territory the way that honeybees will defend a hive. Most of them don't have stingers, so we don't have to worry about that. But with all wildlife, we want to respect them where they are and help them. What you may not know is that they're pollinating the plants, and guess what? One out of every three pieces of food that we eat, the clothing that we wear, was all pollinated from a plant that was pollinated by an animal, whether it was a bee or a hummingbird or a bat. So we need to be very concerned when we hear statistics that pollinators are decreasing in the United States. So we can help our pollinators by not spraying pesticides, not spraying insecticides. We can create a habitat for them in our yard by leaving some of the leaf litter. When we plant native plants, the bees want to be able to maximize their efforts. So you want at least 3 to 5 feet wide area of flowers. So that means planting multiples of whether it's buckwheat, ceanothus, the mallows, the penstemons, the sages. You want kind of a big area for them so that they don't have to work so hard going from one plant here and another plant way over there. You want it concentrated in a single area.
They are rarely aggressive. They do not sting. They're solitary, and they build nesting places in the ground and in wood.
That is correct. And they get eaten by birds. So it's a nice cycle of life in your backyard.
So much information. Phew. I can't believe how much ground you two have covered. Is there anything else you would like to share before the end of this show?
There's ways that you can get involved with birds in your backyard. I subscribe to Feeder Watch, which is a citizen science research project by Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And that means one weekend a week, I am counting all the birds that I see in the backyard. And I do this in the winter months from November to April. And it's a lot of fun. And the research is being used to track our birds. How are they doing? Are their numbers increasing or decreasing? There's a disease for house finches in their eyes, and the researchers are tracking how that is spreading from the east to the west as a result of our very own input from what we're seeing in our backyards. There's also eBird, which is a way for researchers to tap into all the birds that we are seeing in our yards and on our trips. And it's very, very useful. So I would encourage you, as the general public, to go ahead and subscribe to Feeder Watch and report your bird sightings on eBird.
Now, I'm just a beginning bird watcher, and personally, I would be afraid of identifying a bird incorrectly. What can support me?
You can go to any of the online bird guides. You can call the Audubon House and get help. But you don't have to worry about not just being a beginner, because even beginning sightings are going to help the researchers.
There are some apps for my phone that I've added that can help me identify birds.
Yes, I use, well, there's apps from National Geographic. There are, the app that I'm most fond of is this David Sibley app, and it's called Birds of North America. And the entire book is on my phone and provides wonderful pictures, descriptions of the birds in all seasons. But when I started birding, I just kept it very simple. And maybe there's 4 or 5 birds that are always in my backyard. For instance, the house finch. So learn the house finch, watch its behavior, and then soon you'll see perhaps some little sparrow down picking up the leftover seeds around the ground and see if you can find it. And maybe it's going to be a little song sparrow. So then you've learned too. And we all know the mockingbird that sings all through the night this time of year. And you're going to watch it eat the berries. So then you've got three species that you know. And it'll just grow from there.
Also, Cornell Lab of Ornithology has a program called Merlin. So if you go to Merlin, you can either do a picture or words, and it will give you options based on your description or your photo about what bird that might be. So that's some help if you're trying to identify a bird.
And aren't we lucky that we all have cell phones? And I see people carrying these lenses around that would probably break my back. They're so heavy. But really, if you're within about 10 feet of a bird at your feeder, you can get a pretty fair picture of it on your cell phone, and then you have some time to go in and look through the book and find it and learn its name and learn when it's going to be in your yard. It's very exciting.
Great ideas. Before we end the show, did we talk a little bit about the seed feeders? We've talked about hummingbird feeders, but the seed feeders.
Mm-hmm. I use seed feeders in my yard. Perhaps some people are against that. I take very, very careful care of them. I clean them as efficiently as I do my hummingbird feeders. I go to a birding store and I buy the seed that is called no waste, which means that every seed in it is consumed completely, and therefore I don't get the mounds of seed waste underneath the feeder. And the mounds of seed waste get full of bacteria and
fungal infections.
And so I would recommend that if you choose to feed birds, buy the seed that is, it's a little more, it's actually quite a bit more costly, I have to be honest, but it is a no-waste seed product.
Gee, I didn't know about the fungus that can develop on the seeds that grow on the seed,
waste on the ground.
The waste on the ground.
To say nothing of the fact that those seeds that the birds don't eat are going to begin growing. And one year I started noticing I had quite a bit of corn growing in my in my hillside house yard. And I realized, well, I'm feeding them feed that has corn in it. Of course I'm getting corn growing in my yard. At least it was an easy weed to pull.
And rats, too.
Rats, yes.
Right? Oh, we have come to the close of our bird-friendly show for In the Garden. We've covered how to create a bird-friendly garden in Orange County, plants favorable to birds, keeping bird nests safe and our trees healthy, and ended with talking about the demonstration pollinators garden right across from UCI at the San Joaquin Wildlife Sanctuary. Thank you very, very much, Trudy Hurd and Carolyn Noble, for sharing your expertise and time with us. I like to end my shows with this reminder: gardeners live longer, healthier, and happier lives. And now I can add, gardeners and bird watchers live longer, healthier, and happier
we
lives.
We hope so.
Thank you for listening to KUCI 88.9 FM In the Garden Show. Tune in every week on Thursday, 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. for another green topic.